This is VOA News via remote. I'm Laurel Bowman. U.S. President-elect Joe Biden used his first national address as the projected winner to vow healing for a deeply divided nation. And he reached out to the millions of people who voted against him, saying, "Let's give each other a chance." His calls for reconciliation came even as U.S. President Donald Trump argued that the election had been stolen from him and that legal proceedings would ensue. As he heads towards Inauguration Day on January 20th, Biden's top priority is expected to be quickly naming a chief of staff. And he said Saturday that he would announce a task force of scientists and experts Monday to develop a blueprint to begin beating back the coronavirus. He said his plan would be built on bedrock science. He has promised that he will ask Dr. Anthony Fauci to stay on in his role. Fauci is the top U.S. infectious diseases expert who has clashed with President Trump. Biden's team is also considering a climate czar to deliver on the promises made during his campaign to tackle that issue. Former U.S. President George W. Bush, a Republican, said on Sunday he has spoken to President-elect Joe Biden, a Democrat, to congratulate him on his victory. In a statement, Bush said Americans can have confidence that the U.S. election was, quote, fundamentally fair, its integrity will be upheld, and its outcome is clear, end quote. He added that President Trump has the right to request recounts and pursue legal challenges. Congratulations from leaders around the world have been coming in for Joe Biden, including from German Chancellor Angela Merkel, French President Emmanuel Macron, and British Prime Minister Boris Johnson. This morning, His Holiness the Dalai Lama wrote to congratulate him, saying, "Particularly in these challenging times, I hope you will be able to contribute to shaping a more peaceful world in which people suffering poverty and injustice find relief." This is VOA News. Ethiopia's Tigray region president said Sunday it would be good to try to stop the fighting with federal troops and to negotiate. But he added that the region will keep on defending itself until federal authorities agree to talk. He said the federal government had lost authority in the region, despite claims to the contrary in the days-old conflict, which neighbors fear could result in all-out war. The Tigray's dominated politics in Ethiopia for nearly three decades before the current prime minister came to power in 2018 on the back of anti-government protests. The long-running feud became more intense recently after Tigray held its own elections in September, defying the national government, which had decided to postpone national polls due to the coronavirus pandemic. Bolivia's Luis Arce was sworn in as president on Sunday, ushering the country's powerful socialist party back into power a year after long-term leftist leader Evo Morales was ousted amid angry protests. Arce was inaugurated in a ceremony in the highland city of La Paz in front of heads of state from Argentina, Paraguay, Colombia, and Spain, as well as senior officials from Chile, Iran, and the government of Venezuela's Nicolas Maduro. Many say the former economy minister was behind the rapid growth under Morales, but he has many political divisions to heal. Morales, who led the country for almost 14 years as the first indigenous president, sparked a widespread backlash last year when he ran for an unprecedented fourth term in the face of term limits and a national referendum. After claiming victory in that election, Morales was eventually forced to resign amid protests. Thousands of opposition supporters rallied Sunday in ex-Soviet Georgia to demand a snap vote after the opposition accused the ruling party of rigging tightly contested parliamentary elections. The main thoroughfare of the capital, Tbilisi, turned into a sea of Georgia's red and white five-cross flags as protesters gathered outside parliament. The ruling Georgian Dream Party, led by a billionaire ex-prime minister, which won the October 31st polls with a 2% margin, has flatly denied the accusations of electoral fraud. But all of Georgia's opposition parties have refused to enter the new parliament, sparking fears of another political crisis in the Black Sea nation, where elections are often followed by accusations of fraud and mass demonstrations. And Myanmar voted on Sunday in a general election seen as a referendum on the fledgling democratic government that remains popular at home but has seen its reputation collapse overseas amid allegations of genocide. Via remote, Laurel Bowman, VOA News.
This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this politics edition of the program, counting mail-in ballots delays the outcome of the 2020 presidential race. And the anticipated blue wave fails to materialize in congressional races for both the House of Representatives and the Senate. Hello again. I'm Carol Castiel. Well, our valued political analysts, Jim Kessler and John Fortier, had thought we might have clear results on election night, November 3rd. But that did not happen. The unprecedented number of mail-in ballots across the country has delayed results for not only the presidency, but also several key Senate races, which could determine the balance of power in the Senate, which is currently controlled by Republicans. In the House of Representatives, Democrats are likely to hold their majority, but contrary to analysts' predictions, they actually lost rather than gained seats. As we've said many times on this broadcast, in the United States, it is the Electoral College, not the national popular vote, which determines the winner of the presidential contest. Going into Saturday and Sunday, Democratic candidate former Vice President Joe Biden was leading the electoral count, with key races in Pennsylvania, Georgia, Nevada, and North Carolina still undecided. The state of Arizona was called by the Associated Press and Fox News as a win for Democrat Joe Biden. According to my VOA newsroom colleague, Ken Breedemeyer, if Mr. Biden can hold his vote lead in Arizona with its 11 electors and Nevada with 6, he could reach the 270 Electoral College majority and become the country's 46th president at his inauguration in January, no matter the outcome in Georgia and Pennsylvania. This illustrates that Joe Biden has an Electoral College advantage and many more pathways to the 270 Electoral College votes needed to win than does U.S. President Donald Trump. Mr. Biden currently leads the national popular vote by more than 4 million. For his part, President Donald Trump, who is trailing as the mail-in ballots are being methodically counted by impartial election officials in the contested states, has been making what many analysts say are unfounded accusations against Democrats by asserting that they are, quote, trying to steal the election with mail-in ballots, close quote. However, in the state of Georgia, where Mr. Biden has overtaken President Trump, there is a Republican governor and state legislature. Many analysts and lawmakers on both sides of the aisle are praising the state's conduct of the elections. Each state administers its elections, often with varying rules that govern early voting and the use of mail-in ballots. Each state, whether controlled by Democrats or Republicans, prides itself on the professional conduct of their election officials. On Wednesday evening, President Trump falsely claimed victory and asserted that there has been widespread fraud related to mail-in ballots, even though no evidence exists to support that allegation. Republicans have been filing lawsuits alleging vote tabulation irregularities, some of which have already been tossed out. For his part, former Vice President Joe Biden is urging Americans to have patience and remain calm and wait for every vote to be counted. For more on the 2020 election and ramifications for the U.S. political landscape, we turn to our regular analysts. John Fortier, with his finger on the pulse of Republicans, is director of governmental studies at the Bipartisan Policy Center, and that's a prominent think tank here in Washington. And Jim Kessler, he's former aide to Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer. He's currently executive vice president for policy at Third Way. That's a centrist policy group based here in Washington. And both gentlemen join me, as usual, via Microsoft Teams. Gentlemen, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Carol.
Great to be here.
Yes, indeed. Well, John, let me begin with you. Of course, I'm not trying to embarrass either of you. We all thought maybe we would know the results on election night, but it didn't quite materialize. What's your take on what we know as of now? Give us your assessment.
Well, I think a couple of big points about the election. I think in many ways, the pollsters and projectors were wrong about the size of a Democratic wave or a Biden win. There were many indications, both at the national level and in many state polls, that this would not be as tight a contest as it seems to be. So Republicans had a very good night in all sorts of ways, winning some states and holding on to places that people thought would not go. Florida, places like Ohio and Iowa, where Republicans did extremely well, where they were thought to not do so well. I think especially significant, they've done very well in the Senate and the House. The House will still be Democratic, but a lot closer. And the Senate, you know, I think the most likely scenario is that Republicans will hold the Senate, maybe with 52 seats. It will depend on a couple of runoffs in Georgia, likely, but I think they're probably more likely to go Republicans' way. So a very good night for Republicans in all sorts of ways. A good night for Donald Trump, too, in part. Certainly, his coalition came out in many ways in bigger margins than people expected. I do think that Donald Trump overperformed expectations, but is sitting now in a position where he has fewer paths to the nomination than does Joe Biden. He's still likely to lose the national popular vote by a significantly larger margin than he did in 2016. Lots of votes will be coming in over the next week or two from places like California, New York, which I think will boost his lead to 4.5% of the popular vote, something like that. But again, today he sits with the possibility of winning very narrowly, and that is prevailing in Georgia, North Carolina, and Pennsylvania. And even if he did that, partly because of a quirk in the Electoral College where Joe Biden has likely won one elector out in Nebraska, he's still one elector short. And so he would have to win again in Arizona or Nevada. It does mean basically that Donald Trump, all of those states are going to have to go his way, or at least they're going to have to end up being so close that we're going to recount. I think the danger is, especially a state like Pennsylvania, that the movement and the number of votes out there is towards the Democrats. And a small margin for Joe Biden in Pennsylvania means we're recounting. But a larger margin means that Donald Trump's path to the presidency has cut off. So again, a very good night for Donald Trump and Republicans. But at this point, it looks like his paths are not so great and may fall short by just a little bit in the Electoral College.
Over to you, Jim Kessler. A good night for President Trump and the Republicans. On the other hand, as John Fortier just said, President Trump is falling short, and particularly he has many fewer pathways to win the Electoral College than does Joe Biden, the Democrat.
I don't think it was a very good night for Donald Trump, and he certainly has not acted since the polling has closed on Tuesday that it's been a good night for him and a good week for him. As of this moment, the presidential election has not been officially called, but Joe Biden is going to win the national vote by well over 5 million votes and by somewhere between 4% and 5%. We don't elect presidents by the national vote. We elect them by the Electoral College, which means what happens in the states. Joe Biden, either in states that have already been called or in states that are on the verge of being called, will easily pass the 270 Electoral College votes necessary to become president. So in that sense, this was a great night for Democrats. It was a great night for Joe Biden. It was a terrible night for Donald Trump. When you get down ballot, it was a disappointment for Democrats. They expected to expand their majority in the House. They will not. That majority in the House will shrink by somewhere between 7 and 10 members. They expected to at least pull even in the Senate to get to 50-50, where with a Democratic president, Joe Biden, the vice president would be the deciding vote. That is possible. But I agree with John. It is only in the realm of possibility. It's not in the realm of likelihood. And I think what we saw out there, a couple of things. John was right. The pollsters got it wrong again. They missed on this, and that has become a recurring theme in American politics. And second is, there were enough voters out there who said, I trust Joe Biden, but I'm not really sure I trust Joe Biden with a Democratic majority in both houses of Congress. I'm worried that elements of the Democratic Party have gone too far left, and they split their tickets in some places. And Joe Biden is going to win by several million votes more than congressional candidates. So his coattails didn't really exist.
All right, gentlemen, that's a very interesting assessment on the overall outcome as we know it. So back to you, John Fortier. As you said, the Republicans did very well, notwithstanding they did not win the House of Representatives, but they gained many more seats. They are probably going to hold in the Senate. But let's take a look at what do you think the factors were that drove these elections? And in addition to that, I wanted to get your take on, you know, the mail-in ballots, because President Trump and the Republicans have been disparaging mail-in ballots for quite a while. And now that is coming out as one of their arguments for questioning the validity and the integrity of the elections. What's your comment with regard to that skepticism?
First on the factors, and I think there's a lot to be said about demographic shifts, and we can talk about this. I think we're going to analyze this, especially as we go forward and have more data. But, you know, I think two big factors out there are the coronavirus and Joe Biden. That if you looked at where Donald Trump was in January, February, he arguably would have been in a better place. Many people are saying in some ways it's surprising that Donald Trump didn't do worse because of the coronavirus, a cataclysmic event that affects the economy and people's lives all over the world. But I got to think that he was sitting there in a better position with a better economy without this in January, February, you know, small marginal changes probably help him. Joe Biden, second point, a better nominee for Democrats than their other alternatives, you know, more moderate, older, and had a slightly different coalition. You know, most Democrats were going to vote for any Democratic nominee. But if you think of Joe Biden being able to, not just because he was born in Pennsylvania, but just to have some more resonance, especially across the Midwest, where the margins that it looks like he's going to win key states in the Midwest are, I think they're going to be clear, but they're going to be small. And so a couple of percentage points change in the other direction across the way. And Donald Trump is president and Republicans do even better in the election. So I think those are the two biggest factors that we could think about just in a macro way that things could have gone differently, but for that. On the voting by mail, look, we did do an incredible change in our election to go from already a pretty substantial amount of voting by mail, maybe 23% or so of Americans, to nearly doubling that. And, you know, that's caused some controversy. I guess my view is I think there are some legitimate issues about whether we should vote by mail, and some of those may be different during the pandemic and other times. We can argue about that. And around the edges, I think there are some legitimate litigation going on as to what we should do about certain classes of ballots. But the big picture of ballots that were cast through the mail, through other ways that are being counted now, most of them are being counted in a pretty traditional way. They're ballots that have already arrived, that have come through, that are non-controversial. And so talk about stopping the counting or those ballots are really illegitimate. You know, I think the battles to whether we should have voted that way had been lost earlier. And they're legitimate ballots that are likely to be counted. If we do end up in a really close, tight situation, which I'm not sure we're going to, I agree with Jim about Pennsylvania is likely to move, I think, more significantly to Joe Biden, you know, then I think all of these smaller issues, which reflect the differences between the parties and what we should do about different types of ballots that have come in and where we're going to be in court, those are all live issues. But the big issue of the counting of the basic votes that came in, whether they came in by mail or in person, that is still going on is the counting of ballots that no court is going to step in and stop, and that we're going to see the results of that before we would get to any recounts or real challenges.
Jim Kessler, please hold your thoughts. I'm going to take a quick break and go right to you with the same question. You're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. Our guests are John Fortier, from whom you just heard. He's Director of Governmental Studies at the Bipartisan Policy Center, and Jim Kessler, co-founder and Executive Vice President for Policy at Third Way. And they join me via Microsoft Teams. We are discussing the conduct and outcome of the 2020 presidential and congressional races. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to a loyal fan and Twitter follower, Feroz Khan from the Jammu and Kashmir region. As always, if you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. And next week on Encounter, we talk with two analysts about how a Biden presidency would likely affect U.S. foreign policy. And on Press Conference USA, we feature political analyst Elaine Kmark, who will offer more analysis on the outcome of the presidential and congressional races. That's next week on Encounter and Press Conference USA. Well, back to our program, and let me go to Jim Kessler to answer the same question I posed to John Fortier. What do you think motivated people to vote for either Joe Biden or the president? Most people say it was a referendum on President Trump. And of course, John Fortier was saying Joe Biden was probably a better candidate for the Democrats. And yet, it seems that Mr. Trump was relatively successful with constant assertions that, well, if you vote for Joe, he's going to shut down America or have socialist policies, which couldn't be further from the truth if you look at Joe Biden. But somehow these types of narratives did seem to resonate. And then secondly, your view of how the mail-in went and Mr. Trump's assertions that there's a lot of fraud without evidence and asking for vote counting to be stopped, you know, if he's winning and to continue when it appears that he's losing in a particular state. There's a bit of a contradiction there.
Well, consistency has never really been Donald Trump's strong suit. Let me start with your second half of the question first. This vote went off remarkably well, and the people in the states and cities and counties of America deserve a lot of credit, dealing with a lot of variables and a lot of changes and a pandemic, and they pulled it off, and congratulations to them. They are all small heroes in this country. It is also a shame that Donald Trump is denigrating the mail-in ballots and the counting of the votes, and my hope is that this is the final stain, the final piece of damage, the final bit of destruction that he is able to reap over this country. It's a shame. He's wrong on this. And I'm glad that some Republican leaders have stood up and have told him to stand down on this. On the election and Joe Biden, John Fortier is right. Joe Biden was the right candidate to take on Donald Trump. I'm not sure anybody else in that large field would have been able to win this race. That is not to say that Donald Trump is popular. He's not popular. He's never been a popular president, even when the economy was good. He's never been a popular president. But the Democrats are a party that has been divided for the last several years. And those vocal wing of the party, but it's a minority wing of the party, that is pretty far left. And, you know, through social media and through other efforts, they are the loudest voice within the Democratic Party. Joe Biden, because he's been around for so long, is able to be a counterweight to that and to say, look, I beat the socialist. I mean, that was a line that he said over and over again about him beating Bernie Sanders. He wasn't saying that to brag. He was saying that because they obviously saw in all their polling and their research that enough voters were afraid that Democrats were going to take this country too far left on the economy and on other issues, you know, maybe having to do with police or on some environmental issues. And Biden was the person who could counter that. And then you saw throughout this race, Donald Trump really had a difficult time in trying to define who Joe Biden was. Was he too old? Was he too enfeebled? Hunter Biden, was he too beholden to the left? He never really knew how to take on Joe Biden. And in the end, it looks like Joe Biden will beat him.
Back to you, John Fortier. Quickly, on the question of litigation, some election attorneys assert that a litigation strategy, which seems to be the one that President Trump is pursuing, doesn't usually flip the outcome of the election. Where do you come down on that?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that there are some legitimate issues that they are pursuing in court. They may not win on all those issues, but they're the type of issues that are pretty specific. Even, you know, some of the bigger questions, we have one in Pennsylvania about the deadline for ballots coming in, some of the ballots coming in afterwards, partly because we voted so many early. I think that pile is not so large, but, you know, it's about a specific set of ballots. Should Republicans have access to the counting? Generally, I say yes, but the court has decided in a certain way how that will happen. A legitimate point to bring up, but it's not going to affect the counting of the big ballots. And I think the answer is we do think that, especially Pennsylvania, some of the outstanding ballots, the regularly cast ballots, probably are going to be counted and the margin's going to be pretty big. But if it's not, if we end up in Georgia, which is very close now, in Pennsylvania, we end up close in Arizona, where we're talking about a few thousand votes, probably lower thousands rather than higher, then there'll be all sorts of litigation. There'll be recounts. We'll be fighting over everything. If it's bigger than that, the idea that perhaps a recount could be called is true, but that's unlikely to change the outcome. So I guess I think the litigation is not going to stop the big counting of the kind of more regular vote that is still going on in some places. It might affect some of the little issues that become relevant if we are much closer after that big counting gets near the end.
Jim Kessler, do you think that the margin of victory that you believe Joe Biden will win by will be large enough to mitigate or pretty much undermine any litigation strategy that President Trump is trying to pursue to try to flip the outcome of the election?
Yeah, this election, when all the votes are counted, this election, except maybe in one or two states, the outcome will be clearly known. No amount of legal wrangling will change that. And those one or two states, and Georgia is prime among them, is not the state that would determine who would win the presidency. when it's ultimately said and done, the people who are looking at what are the remaining ballots out there in Pennsylvania, like, they believe that Joe Biden's going to win by 100,000 votes in Pennsylvania. Like, he's going to win by several percentage points. When there are court challenges, votes swing by several hundred, not by several thousand, and certainly not several tens of thousands there. One of the things that will be interesting is, what are Republican legislators, the leaders like Senator Mitch McConnell, who's the Republican majority leader in the Senate, and other leaders of the Republican Party, what will they be saying and doing when it is beyond a shadow of a doubt that Joe Biden is the next president, and that all these legal challenges are really, for the most part, baseless and designed only to sow doubt on our democracy and prolong what we all know is the outcome, and that's that Joe Biden is president. And will they start to tear themselves away from Trump? Hope the answer is yes, but we'll have to see.
As we close, John Fortier, what would you say to Jim Kessler, who is wondering what some of the stalwart Republicans would do should President Trump continue to sow doubt and even potentially incite some violence or chaos? How do you think the Republicans, the senators and members of Congress, will handle this vis-a-vis Mr. Trump?
Well, look, I'll just say again, I think the rhetoric of what's being said about sort of stopping the count or the big picture votes being somehow out of order is not right. The litigation is really much more narrowly focused. So there's a mismatch of those two things. And I think that'll, you know, likely become clear as the more regular vote comes in. I do think just one more important thing that we really haven't talked about on the positive side for Republicans, I think the great likelihood is that Joe Biden will come out of this as the president, but he's likely to be the president without a Senate and with a very narrow House. And I think that's a very tough position for Democrats to be in. They're going to not have certainly the robust legislative agenda we were hearing about, or the one that could have happened with a much bigger Senate majority, packing the court, adding states, climate change, major changes in healthcare. Not that there couldn't be some negotiation between the parties on some of these issues, but it's, in some ways, it's all off the table, and likely, you know, a midterm looming in a couple of years where there generally is good news for the out party. So it isn't a good night for Donald Trump in the sense that he's likely to lose the election. But for the party and for his supporters and others who have come out for the Republicans, they are much happier about what happened in this election. And it is going to directly affect both the governing of the next 2 years and really perhaps the control of the bodies in 2 years from now.
John Fortier, I can't thank you enough for bringing that point out. And I'm going to conclude with Jim Kessler for a response, a very interesting point. How do you think a President Biden would deal with that? Will his calls for bipartisanship, his relationships with senators on both sides of the aisle, will that somehow offset those obstacles?
Assuming Joe Biden is the next president, he will be the first Democrat to take office without controlling both houses of Congress since Grover Cleveland in the 19th century. Okay, so this is very unusual. President coming in and not having control of Congress, it's certainly unusual for a Democrat. Yes, it means that the ambition has to be scaled back. I will say this, Joe Biden also enters the presidency with a greater knowledge of the Senate and of Congress than any president since Lyndon Johnson in the 1960s, and also with deeper relationships with people from both parties of any president also since Lyndon Johnson. So if anyone is going to be able to work with this situation and come out with progress and to be able to break the gridlock and to pass legislation, Joe Biden is the right person to be doing this. But a lot of this will also depend on Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, who is a Republican, who in the past, and the Republican strategy in the past when Democrats have taken office, has really been to stonewall everything. And I just think they're going to have to decide whether that's what they want to do or not. And if they don't want to stonewall everything, then there's room for negotiations there. And if they do, well, we're just going to have to replay this again in the next election.
All right, gentlemen, this conversation will be continued, but I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, John Fortier, Director of Governmental Studies at the Bipartisan Policy Center, and Jim Kessler, Executive Vice President for Policy at Third Way. Gentlemen, once again, thanks for a terrific conversation and analysis, and we'll check in with you again as soon as the results are more officially clarified. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Encounter was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Gary Jaffe and Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.
Hello, and welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ana Mateo. This program is for English learners, so we speak a bit slower, and we use words and sentences especially written for people learning English. Here are the stories we have for you today. For the Education Report, Dr. Jill Robbins and Gregory Stockel explain how to write a good email. Susan Shand reports on the cruise industry and their terrible year in 2020. I will return with this week's words and their stories. We will finish our 30 minutes together with The Making of a Nation, our ongoing U.S. history program. But first, the Education Report.
Email is one of the most important ways through which we communicate. It has become part of most everyone's day-to-day life. Writing a good email can mean the difference between someone reading it and writing back and someone ignoring it altogether. Do you have questions on how to make your message more effective? Today on Education Tips, we will answer the question, how can I make my emails better? Emails are made up of four different parts:
the subject line, the opening, the body, and the closing.
Let us explore how to make each of these parts better.
The subject line is what the other person, or receiver, will read first. The subject line is usually the most important part of an email. It should be short, but contain enough details that the receiver recognizes the subject of the email. A good subject line sets the expectations for the email. A bad subject line can mean the receiver will not read the email. Some people will add the word important to the subject line, but this does not provide enough information. Instead of writing important, two better choices for subject lines are:
meeting tomorrow at 10 a.m. to discuss new changes. Question about future classes. As in any form of writing, you should know your audience. The opening of an email depends on things like how formal the relationship is. If you are sending an email to a friend or someone you work with, two good openings or greetings are:
good morning, good afternoon, hello, or hello and the person's name.
If you are sending the email to someone you do not know and it is a formal situation, some possible openings are:
dear, name of department, to whom it may concern.
In a formal situation, when you know the name of the person, a good opening is simply:
dear, title, family name, as in, dear Mr. Brown. The body of the email is where you ask for what you need, or make clear your reason for writing the email. This could be asking them a question or keeping them informed. The body of the email should prioritize the most important information. It should be direct, and it is wise to keep it short. If the person you are emailing does not know you, you should introduce yourself in the first few lines. You might write,
my name is Patricia Jones. I am sending this email to get some more information about the job you advertised. After you have introduced yourself and given your reason for writing, you can follow this with the body of your email. The most important information should come first. This makes your email clear to your receiver and saves them time. Here is an example.
I wanted to know if you are currently accepting applications. If so, where can I send my information? Additionally, will you be meeting people in person or online?
It is important to clearly explain yourself in as few words as possible. Try to keep your email short but polite. This is important because you want to make yourself clear to your receiver.
The last part to a good email is the closing. It is usually one or two words that let the receiver know that this is the end of the email. The ending should include your name and tell the receiver where you work and what you do. A few different closings are:
kind regards, best, thank you.
Some applications create an automatic signature for the sender. This is useful because it saves time when you are writing.
If you follow these suggestions, you will find that you receive more responses to your emails. Effective email writing is important, especially now when so much of what we do is online. I'm Gregory Stockel.
And I'm Jill Robbins.
Our next story is from Susan Shand.
The vacation cruise industry has accepted it cannot restart operations this year. Major cruise lines Carnival and Norwegian recently extended a halt on cruises through the end of the year. Then, the cruise industry representative group said Tuesday that its members have agreed they would not sail for the rest of 2020. The announcement comes just days after the U.S. government effectively lifted its no-sail order, even though there is a worldwide increase in coronavirus infections. Cruise Lines International Association represents 95% of cruise lines, including Princess, Carnival, and Royal Caribbean. It said its members have voluntarily decided to shut down cruise operations in the U.S. through the end of the year. Members will use the remainder of the year to prepare for extensive measures to address COVID-19 safety, with the guidance of public health experts and the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the association said. On Friday, federal health officials announced new rules permitting large cruise ships to start sailing again in U.S. waters, but not immediately. The CDC will require that ship owners must test all passengers and crew at the start and end of each cruise. Only 7-day cruises will be permitted. In March, the CDC ordered cruise ships to stop sailing to the U.S. after several outbreaks showed officials that the ships were spreading COVID-19 infection. The announcement last week brings the no-sail order to an end. The cruise industry closed for business in the middle of March because of the virus. The cruise industry estimates the economy lost $25 billion in economic activity and about 164 American jobs. The CDC's new rules say that in order to start carrying passengers, the companies must show they can test and quarantine anyone who gets the virus. Among other requirements, they will have to build testing laboratories on all ships and make their own plans to isolate or quarantine passengers at ports if needed. I'm Susan Shand.
And now, words and their stories from VOA Learning English. Wind is a powerful force in nature. High wind speeds from tornadoes, hurricanes, and other violent storms can cause great destruction. But wind can also be a force for good. It can turn machinery that produces energy. It can help boats sail great distances. In the wild, wind can provide life-saving information to some animals. And it doesn't need to be a strong wind. For example, a scent or smell carried by a light breeze can tell a deer about the presence of a hunter just a few meters away. The wind can provide useful information to people, too. When we get wind of something, we hear some news or information that has been kept private. Naturally, this air of secrecy makes it even more interesting. When using this expression, remember this. When we get wind of something, we become aware of the information through indirect means. In other words, we learn of it secondhand or through the grapevine. We do not hear it straight from the source. The wind might give others information that we want to keep quiet. For example, the leaders of the company were worried about investors getting wind of the factory fire. If the investors knew, they would probably withdraw their money and invest elsewhere. Here is another example. The filmmakers did not want the media to get wind of the actor's latest arrest. After all, she is playing a police officer in the movie. At times, the information or news sent by the wind is bad, just gossip or talk, and not really helpful at all. For example, if someone asks me, "Did you hear that so-and-so lost his job?" I can answer, "Yeah, I got wind of that yesterday." But sometimes the news or information is not bad. It is just something you want to keep secret. Like the time I tried to plan a surprise party for my best friend. I did not want him to get wind of it. That would ruin the surprise. But it is so difficult keeping anything from him. He is nosy and asks a lot of questions, such as, why are you calling all my friends? Why are you buying so much food and drinks? Are you planning a party for me? So much for that surprise party. Now, this expression is not always about learning private information or keeping secrets. The wind can send us information that we need to make good decisions. For example, I was just about to buy tickets to a big 3-day outdoor music event. But then I got wind that my favorite performer, and the only reason I was going, had canceled. Thank goodness a friend of a friend of a friend told me, or I would not have known. And that is all the time we have for this Words in Their Stories. I will have a new story for you next week. But if I get wind of a change in plans, I'll make sure to let you know. Until next time, I'm Anna Mateo. Listen to the wind blow. Where does the wind go? What does the wind know? Listen to the wind blow. Listen to the wind blow. Listen to the wind blow.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In July of 1861, Union soldiers from the North and Confederate soldiers from the South fought the first major battle in the American Civil War. They clashed at Manassas, or Bull Run, Virginia, less than 50 kilometers from Washington. The Union soldiers fought fiercely, but two large Confederate forces broke the Union attack. Harry Monroe and Kay Gallant tell about some of the other early battles of the Civil War.
Northerners had expected to win the Battle of Bull Run. They believed the Confederacy would fall if the Union won a big military victory early in the war. Now, however, there was great fear that Southern soldiers would seize Washington. The Union needed to build and train an army quickly. President Abraham Lincoln named General George McClellan to do this. McClellan was 34 years old. The young general had two important tasks. He must defend Washington from attack, and he must build an army to strike at enemy forces in Virginia. McClellan wasted no time. He put thousands of troops into position around the city, and he built 48 forts. After this rush of activity, however, little more happened for a long time. McClellan told his wife, "I shall take my own time to make an army that will be sure of success. As soon as I feel my army is well organized and well trained and strong enough, I will force the rebels to a battle." McClellan kept making excuses for why he would not move against the enemy. His excuses became a continuing source of trouble for President Lincoln. The public, the press, and politicians all demanded that McClellan do something, They wanted to win the war, and win it right away.
McClellan commanded the biggest army in the Union, the Army of the Potomac. But it was not the only army. Others were battling Confederate forces in the West. The Confederates had moved up through Tennessee into the border state of Kentucky. They built forts and other defensive positions across the southern part of the state. They also blocked as many railroads and rivers as they could. Their job was to keep Union forces from invading the South through Kentucky. One of the Union generals in the area was Ulysses Grant. Grant had served in the Army for 20 years. He had fought in America's war against Mexico and had won honors for his bravery. When that war ended, he was sent to an army base far from his wife and children. He did not like being without them, and he did not like being an officer in peacetime. Grant began to drink too much alcohol. He began to be a problem. In 1854, he was asked to leave the army. When the Civil War started, Grant organized a group of unpaid soldiers in Illinois. With the help of a member of Congress, he was named a general. All of the other Union generals knew Ulysses Grant. Few had any faith in his abilities. They were sure he would always fail.
Grant, however, had faith in himself and his men. He believed he could force Confederate soldiers to withdraw from both Kentucky and Tennessee. Then he would be free to march directly into the Deep South, Mississippi. Two Confederate forts stood in Grant's way. They were in Tennessee, close to the Kentucky border. United States Navy gunboats captured the first, Fort Henry, on the Tennessee River. That fort was easy to attack and not well defended. The fighting was over by the time Grant and his men got there. The second, Fort Donelson, was nearby on the Cumberland River. It was stronger and defended by 20,000 soldiers. Grant surrounded the fort and let the Navy gunboats shell it. The fighting there lasted several days.
At one point, the Confederates tried to break out of the fort and escape. They opened a hole in the Union line and began to retreat. Suddenly, however, their commanding officer decided it would be wrong to retreat. He ordered them back to the fort. After that, there was no choice. The Confederates would have to surrender. The commanding officer sent a message to General Grant. What were the terms of surrender? Grant's answer was simple. No terms except unconditional and immediate surrender. The Confederates gave up Fort Donelson. Grant took 14,000 prisoners. It was the greatest Union victory since the start of the war. Ulysses Grant was a hero. Newspapers called him Unconditional Surrender Grant.
After the Union victory at Fort Donelson, Confederate forces withdrew from Tennessee. They moved farther south and began to regroup at Corinth, Mississippi. Confederate generals hoped to build one big army to stop Ulysses Grant. They would have to move fast. Grant was marching toward Corinth with 40,000 men. another 35,000 under the command of Don Buell were to meet him on the way. Grant arrived in the area first. He waited for Buell 30 kilometers from Corinth, near a small country meeting hall called Shiloh Church. Confederate General Albert Sidney Johnston was waiting, too. He had more than 40,000 men, about the same as Grant, and he was expecting another 20,000. But when he learned that Grant was nearby, he decided not to wait. He would attack immediately.
Johnston did not know it, but his attack came as a surprise to the Union Army. Union officers had refused to believe reports that Johnston was on the move. They said his army was not strong enough to attack. Union troops did not prepare defensive positions. They had no protection when the battle began. The fighting at Shiloh was the bitterest of the war. It was not one battle, but many. Groups of men fought each other all across the wide battlefield. From a distance, they shot at each other. Close up, they cut each other with knives. The earth became red with blood. The dead and wounded soon lay everywhere. At first, the Confederates pushed Grant's army back. They had only to break through one more line, and victory would be theirs. But in the thick of the struggle, General Johnston was shot in the leg. The bullet cut through an artery. Johnston bled to death before help arrived. Any hope for a Southern victory at Shiloh died with him. By the time the fighting began again the next day, General Buell had arrived to help Grant. The Confederate Army retreated. The Union Army let it go.
Shiloh, the word itself, came to mean death and destruction. The Battle of Shiloh had brought home to the American people, both of the North and South, the horror of war. It was the first time so many men, 100,000, had fought against each other in the Western world. It was the American people's first real taste of the bloodiness of modern warfare. As one soldier who fought there said, it was too shocking, too horrible. I hope to God that I may never see such things again. The North won the Battle of Shiloh, but it paid a very high price for victory. More than 13,000 Union soldiers were killed, wounded, or missing. On the Confederate side, more than 10,000 soldiers were killed or wounded. The North celebrated the news of its victory, but joy quickly turned to anger when the public learned of the heavy losses. People blamed General Grant. They demanded that President Lincoln dismiss him. Lincoln thought of the two men who were now his top military commanders, McClellan and Grant. They were so different. McClellan organized an army and then did nothing. Grant organized an army and moved. Lincoln said of Grant, "I cannot do without this man. He fights."
And that is our program for today. Thank you for listening. Join us again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Ana Mateo.